Friends Podcast.
Hi, I'm Diane Hunt. I'm an impressionist realist painter connecting with nature through my brush. I work in oil paint and watercolor, and I live in the countryside of Maryland's Eastern Shore, not far from the Chesapeake Bay. You can find me online at dianehuntstudio.com. and on Facebook and Instagram at Diane Hunt Studio.
Hi, I'm Constance Brosnan of Steve Brosnan's Jewelry Designs. I live in Oklahoma on a prairie, and I make handmade jewelry in silver, copper, and brass. I'm an artist that paints. I paint pastels and in oil sometimes.
Hello, this is Bob J. Kale. I'm the host of this podcast. I am a emerging representational artist. I do historic renderings, seascapes, landscapes, botanicals, birds, and whatnot. With a tight illustrative hand in watercolor, pen and ink, and acrylic paints. And I live in Oklahoma City. Well, it is Monday again. My name is Clyde J. Kale, and this is the Artist Friends Podcast, episode 120 for Monday, October the 25th, the last podcast for the month of October. And I'm here with my two best artist friends, Diane Hunt and Constance Bronson. Hello, Diane.
Hi, Clyde. Hi, Constance. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Constance. Glad you could join us.
Yes, thank goodness. Hi, everybody. Hi, Clyde. Hi, Diane.
All right. Welcome to the podcast. And the theme for this week is some more. We're going to continue our discussion a little bit, some more tips on internet marketing without social media. You know, can an artist be successful without using social media? And there's an interesting video there. If our listeners go to www.talkartpodcast.com, talkartpodcast.com, there, see the video links. There's a couple short videos there. One is about, can an artist become successful without social media? And the other one is just a general internet marketing video of a gentleman who kind of like, it's a rant on some of the worst internet marketing, you know, techniques. And he has some very good points. And Diane, let's start this discussion off. Pick up any extra tips from the these videos.
Well, I mean, she was talking about being successful without social media. It is possible. I mean, that's how we always used to do it before the internet was, you know, came about. And, but I think nowadays it's expected that you should have a website and, you know, have some presence online. Because when you go into galleries or anything, that's always what they ask you. I mean, they want to know what kind of, you know, following you have, how many people you have on your email list, all that kind of stuff. So it's like, it's really expected nowadays. And it is a lot easier to do it, I mean, with online stuff than it was ever offline, you know, because you were limited to really just your own area or places that you knew about. So like now you can go online and just do a search and find galleries all over the place, where before it was really difficult to find them if you didn't know about them already. So, I mean, she said that the three things you need was a website, an email list, and what was the third one? I forget what the third thing was. There was three things. But, I mean, I think most artists nowadays have a website. But I mean, I know people that are full-time artists that don't, They don't do any social media. They only do, you know, local shows or whatever, and that's what they've been doing for years, and that's what all they do. So, I mean, they don't even know how to like navigate on a computer or do, you know, I mean, they're always asking me, how do you do stuff? Because they don't have any clue how to do it. They haven't kept up with it at all. So, I mean, there's pluses and minuses about it. I mean, it does take time, you know, out of your studio time, I guess, to have to do the social media. That is one of the downsides of it. I mean, I'd much rather be painting, and I'm sure you guys would too, rather than doing all this other stuff. But I think a lot less people would know about you if you didn't do it. So,
absolutely. And Constance, did you learn any extra tips or any new tips from the videos?
I don't know that I learned any new tips. I mean, I used to go to art shows and you know, you have a venue, and then what you said was a way to advertise. And, you know, then another thing she mentioned was having emails and sending emails out. You know, you do that even if you don't do the others online stuff. Although I've never really gotten into doing the email thing. But I have in the past done the show thing. And even though what I did do, I did do the show thing in Oklahoma City for a while. And even when I applied with them, when I was selling jewelry and applied with them, they wanted to know what my Instagram was like. And they wanted to know they wanted to see all of my social media, because they wanted to see what it was like before they signed me in to do with them. It is true. Nowadays, they want to see your social media and see how many followers you have, see how many, you know, see what your work looks like. It kind of gives them the idea of whether you're really working or you're just new or what. You know, they like to know, you know, if you're active or if you're just...
That is a very good point. You know, last week we thoroughly, the videos was, should artists completely quit social media? And we came to conclusion, no, but you don't have to put as much effort into it as other webinars and seminars, you know, suggests. Yes, it is true. You do have to have some social media presence. And when you're entering the juried shows, regardless if you're entering local or entering online shows and art contests, part of the application is they want to know what your Instagram account is, what your Facebook, you know, is, you know, to see if you have, you know, a bit of a history. I mean, if you put this wonderful piece of artwork that you did in 2008, but you hadn't done anything since then, that's not going to get you into the show.
Right. I mean, they want to know, they just want to see that you're busy.
About your art career. Yes, you're pursuing that. And that's a very good thing, because it used to be, and Diane has told us stories about this, where you had to take make slides and carry this big three ring binder around of your art to go to galleries.
I've done it. Diane's done it. I've done it. And go to some city and just carry that binder around with you and slides around with you and go in and out doors without bothering people.
Well,
that was the old way of doing it. Then, you know, get in the back of artist magazines and look for the different places and send the slides off, you know, trying to get in to galleries that way.
But with Instagram and Facebook, that serves that same purpose. It's like your portfolio, you know. Mm-hmm. In a sense, and the same way in your web, you know, your website, you know, is so, you know, that the actively posting your work. And I will admit, being, you know, online and everything, I've exhibited in, overseas, you know, in Barcelona and in Switzerland several times, and in Florida, and this was all, you know, online, you know, digital. And had I not had an online presence, those things would not have come about. You know, here I am in Oklahoma City, you know, how the hell did you, How'd you end up in Switzerland, Clyde? Yeah. It's through entering these online contests. And as a result, I've got my name on a mailing list. And so I get what's called artist calls, you know, every month. I get anywhere between 10 and 15 different artist calls, you know, and some of them from others that I've never heard of. And I kind of investigate, because there's always an application fee and you can go broke if you're not careful, you know. $30 here, $40, $15, $50, and after a while it adds up. So it's flattering, but I'm also very selective. But all this happened because of, internet marketing, the getting out there, on the internet. Now, the next video, the gentleman who his rant, what'd you think about that, Diane?
Well, I mean, what he was talking about was marketing and the strategy that's going around, that basically most, if not all, marketers use, is to show the what and then make them pay for the how. So, yep. And I've heard that myself from different classes I've taken. So it is a common strategy that a lot of places use.
And
I'm not convinced that it's totally bogus, but I can see
it's not totally bogus. And I'll tell you, I have fallen victim to that one because it teaches you how to do a campaign on Facebook or some other thing. And that's what I did, but I didn't know that you could go to Facebook and learn how to do the same thing. So if you go to Facebook and go in the background of Facebook, and you can learn how to get back into the background of Facebook by doing that. And they call it blueprint, Facebook's blueprint. And you can learn the same thing by going to the background in Facebook and learning to do the same thing. It's like doing marketing in, if they call it campaigns. And, how Facebook will have you spend money to do a painting. When you do a painting or something, and you can spend money on seeing how many clicks you can get.
Yeah.
And for that painting, and just kind of, and what you do is you try to get more followers and stuff like that.
But what I like, and yes, what he's talking about is not bogus. It's not criminal, it's not immoral, it's not unethical, but it's, in a sense, he's from his own experience. And Gary Vaynerchuk also preaches about this. He talks about give away free. It's kind of like backwards. It's a backwards form of marketing, because everybody is doing it. Okay. Just about everybody, and major heavy hitters. I mean, I don't want to say any names, but several different artists, coaching that we have discussed in our past episodes, that's their technique. They want you to, they give you a little bit useful information, but then they want you for the rest of it, for the how. They want you to, subscribe to their monthly service or take their course, or whatever. And so it's not, anything unethical, but because it's so prevalent and everybody's doing it, if you do the reverse, if you give everything, if you are wanting to create a teaching webinar, if you're wanting to teach something, Give the entire thing away. Provide the what and the how. It will blow people's mind, because they're not used to that. They are just not used to that at all, And it's a good way of developing a loyal following. And then down the road, it's Gary Vaynerchuk's original preaching, when he used to say jab, 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 hit, like a boxing, metaphor. That's what that is, basically. Jab, 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 hit. And so down the road, when you do offer something for sale, they're more likely to buy it, because you've built up a trust, you know, and you don't hear that often from these other, you know, organizations, these other people, you know, because obviously they are invested in getting you to buy their course, you know, to subscribe to their service, you know, and everything. But if you, this is all for, if you want to, you know, I see so many artists that, you know, they create these videos on YouTube and how to do this and how to do that and how to paint. And if you're wanting to do that, I myself, I'm not that interested. I think some people got the impression when we started doing this podcast, this is what we were going to be doing, kind of like creating. And in a sense, I think we've created a bit of a course. We scour and we find resources and we provide it and we talk and share it with, you know, with our own experiences. And I think we're doing exactly what that guy said, because it doesn't cost anything to listen to our podcast. Doesn't cost anything at all, you know, and we've provided some very valuable information, you know, in past episodes and going forward, I hope in, you know, future episodes, you know. Do you agree with that, Diane?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of information online anyway. I mean, the thing the courses do is help bring it all into one place and make it more organized, I guess. So, and you also get, depending on the teacher, you know, if you like the teacher and the way they work and the way they teach, and you start following that one person, then when they have something to sell, you're more likely to buy it because you already have some experience with them. So, I mean, there's so many different strategies on marketing and selling things, you know, the psychological ways of doing things and all that stuff. It's just, yep, mind-boggling how many different ways there is to do it all when you really start delving into it. And it's, you know, it's, I mean, that's just the way it is. And people have to make a living. So
I think of our podcast, I think of the Artist Friends podcast as kind of a curation process. I kind of curate the different information videos that are available for free, you know, on YouTube, and present them, and then we kind of, you know, dissect them and you know, talk about them and share with how we've implemented some of the stuff in our own careers. That's the way I look at it. So yeah, it's a bit of a teaching podcast, but a little bit of entertainment when we get carried away, we get off the beaten track talking about Constance skulls. By the way, Constance collects cow skulls.
When I can find them.
Before we started, she showed me one. I'm getting a little worried, you know, another son didn't know about.
We went on a walkabout yesterday and we were looking for what the Cherokee people call washi, which is a mushroom that grows around some trees. And we didn't find any washi, but we did find a fantastic cow skull. One of the neighbor's cows died last year sometime and the coyotes ate all the good stuff, and the skeleton was laying there, and it was all spread out, I guess, because that's what the animals do. But I found the jawbones and I thought, man, where's the rest of it? So we kept walking and looking around, and I finally found the skull with the horns on it and everything. It was really cool.
That's not
right around Halloween, so that was great.
Yeah, right around Halloween, exactly.
Yeah, and it's a great big old cow skull, so it's really cool. Plus, I picked up a few other bones along the way, too. So I brought two bags with me, and both of them were full. And we were carrying other bones back with us. So besides that, so it was a good haul.
She has one in our studio there. So they're getting me worried, folks.
Well, we used to have skulls, like you had a plastic head, you know, human skull that we used to draw from when I was in college. I still have it somewhere. I don't know where I have it, but I mean, I use that a lot when I was learning to draw the skull and, you know, doing head studies and things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why I have the deer skull, because I had done the same thing with that, did drawings from it. And yeah.
The anatomy helps
in your drawing.
But before we started the recording, listeners, that if the two of them pulls out a big pot, I'm out of here. This close to.
Well, I told him I had two big old black cauldrons out in the yard that I brought up for me from Alabama. I used to cook things in them, but I went ahead and drilled holes in them so I could fill them up with flowers and grow flowers in them.
Good segue into our last part. I thought we would share some of our favorite Halloween stories, growing up. So, all three of us are a part of that baby boomer generation, at different times. And it was really, we are really responsible for bringing the Halloween celebration, full blown with the costumes and trick or treat. And it became a family tradition. And we taught it to our kids. And now it's a big, considered a big holiday, especially for the kids, and everything. And in fact, the whole time when I was little, we always went trick-or-treating all the way up. And then as I got into my teen years, then we went to Halloween parties, and dressed up in costumes,
I'm Baptist now, so we don't do that.
So what's some of your, we'll start with you, Constance. What's, you have any favorite, Halloween stories to share when you were little, or ghost stories, or?
No, not really. We used to just, we used to go over to these people's houses and, we'd dress up over there with their children, and we'd all go out together trick or treating, but that was a Catholic household, and, Catholics used to do that. So,
yeah.
And, yep. We were Catholics then. So,
Diane, what about?
I grew up and became a Baptist, and Baptist people don't do that. So I quit doing it.
What about you?
I grew up in a neighborhood where people would bring their kids into our neighborhood because we had so many good, everybody had decorations up, and the whole neighborhood really got into it. And we used to have 500-600 kids come to the house every Halloween.
Oh my gosh, that's a lot of people.
Yeah. My mom used to get dressed up, and we'd all get dressed up, and we made our own costumes usually. So, we just had a blast doing that. And we would go out and trick or treat, and then my sister, she couldn't eat chocolate. So if she got anything chocolate, I got it. So I made out like a bandit. Well, my brother and I.
Not being able to eat chocolate. I can't eat it now either.
She was allergic to chocolate.
Yeah. That's terrible.
So my brother and I would split her chocolate stuff.
My mother, raised three boys by herself. And so we didn't buy any store-bought, costumes. Except
we never did either.
Except maybe a mask. That's about all she would buy when she could pick up for, 50 cents or whatever. But we had to make all of our own costumes. And we were real little. My brothers came up with an idea of a costume that my mother did not like at all. We got into big trouble when she found out. We took our white bed sheets off our bed. And it was, went around as ghosts.
Oh, my gosh.
Like that. We got off when we got back to the house, and she saw, and she recognized the bed sheets.
Oh, gosh.
She took all the candy away. It wouldn't let us have our candy. So I remember that vividly when we were real little, because I was the oldest. So my two younger brothers, of course, they did what big brother did. So, I was the one that got punished the most. Yeah.
You were the instigator.
But then we always, made costumes. Usually, got a paper bag with punch holes in it and color and paint, whatever. And then my middle brother, he one year he made the best costume. It used to be you could buy milk, and it was be in these cardboard cartons. Okay, so he took an empty cardboard carton and cut it out, and it were square, like a square head. And painted like hair on it, and everything. And then he painted his face green with watercolor paint. He made himself a Frankenstein costume. He was the most coolest looking Frankenstein ever. I mean, it was fantastic. I always remember that. Yeah, that year. And he asked if he could borrow my boots, because my shoes were bigger than his, and had these big old boots for like the Frankenstein. It was incredible. he got a lot of candy. Got a lot of candy. Very inventive, you know, costume. But then in the years when, you know, there was a problem there for a couple years of, you know, poison in the candy and razor. Mm-hmm. The mom started taking us to school, you know, local school, or local churches would hold Halloween parties, and we, you know, dress up and go to the parties, you know, whatever. But over in Italy, when we also, because, you know, the American military, you know, we celebrate Halloween. So the local base at the school there, they had a Halloween party for the kids, for all, because, you know, it wasn't quite considered safe to go around the Italians knocking on the door and begging for candy. So they would go to the, you know, school. In fact, they had two or three parties, different places. So I got my daughters all dressed up, and my youngest daughter, she was only about 3 years old then. And we pulled up and parked. And of course the military guys would get into it big time. They would all dress. Well, one guy, a coworker, this great big, tall black guy. He was like 7 foot tall. He dressed up like, you know, the Black Phantom. You know, he had the white skull on his face, all black, with the Grim Reaper. That's what it was, like the Grim Reaper, you know. He was standing outside greeting, you know, the kids. My daughter, my youngest daughter, saw him. And we would not come out of the car. We had a heck of a time getting her out of the car. Then when she got out of the car in my arms, she literally climbed up over on my back. When he would come next to her, I said, Jim, please, you're scaring her too much. He didn't realize it. She was absolutely terrible. She would not go in that. We had, until he went away, she would not go in that building. Yeah.
Smart girl.
But, so growing up, Halloween is on. Now, something I don't agree with now as adults, you know, who, you know, go to Halloween parties, you know, and dress up. And it's now become quite ridiculous. It's actually become almost satanic celebrations. And it's taken too far. So yeah, we're the baby boomers. We're responsible for it, but we didn't mean it that far. Yeah. It was just fun for the kids and fantasy. Like around Halloween time on my internet radio station, I play a lot of scary shows and everything. And all the shows from the 40s and 50s, they're the scary themes, but there's also the good guy always wins, you know, in the end, you know. And it's like one time Orson Welles was saying, sometimes you want your heart to be warmed with a story, and sometimes you want your spine to tingle. So that's the, you know, the gist of the story. So, I have had many listeners that send me emails that they've got my station playing, you know, on the speakers. They're having a kid's Halloween party, you know, and they're around eating pizza and enjoying some great old time, scary old time radio. So that's how I celebrate Halloween now as an adult. I queue up a lot of my really scary shows, you know, and listen to them. Do you two celebrate Halloween?
Nope. I live out in the country. There's nobody around. It's like, yeah, you know, we never get any people come to the house. It's like,
yep. The cows and the donkeys.
Yeah.
One time when I first moved into this place, because there's a lot of kids. At one time, there was quite a few kids, you know, that lived, you know. So I bought me a big old bag of candy, you know, expecting the kids to show up. Not one kid knocked on the door. So guess who had to eat all that candy?
Poor thing.
Oh, yeah, bye. I had a sugar high you wouldn't believe for eating that candy. I learned my lessons. I don't buy any more candy expecting the kids not coming.
Nowadays, most kids go to, you know, like a school or a church or something, like you were saying.
It's because there's so many.
Yeah, the parades and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many perverts out there now. It's they've ruined it for the kid. You know,
it's just not safe anymore, you know.
Yeah.
They ruined a really, you know, good holiday for the kids, because it was always for the kid, you know. And we all grew up with fond memories, of it. So that will be it. We'll wrap it up. Thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Artist Friends Podcast, episode 120 for October the 25th. And I'm going to say bye to Diane and Constance. Let Diane say goodbye to everybody.
Bye, everyone. Bye, Constance. Bye, Clyde. Happy Halloween.
Good night, Diane. Good night, Clyde. Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening and happy Halloween.
Thank you both for listening. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. And I second it. Have a safe, happy Halloween. It's just fantasy. It's not real life. And we'll see you next time.
The Artist Friends Podcast is produced and edited by Clyde J. Kale. Participating artists, Diane Hunt and Constance Bronson and Clyde J. Kale. You can find more information about Diane Hunt at www.dianehuntstudio.com. Constance Bronson at www.etsy.com/shop/CBROSNANS. Clyde J. Kale at www.cjkaleartworks.com. If you would like to participate or appear as a guest on the Artist Friends Podcast, please email cjkale@mystery-otr.com. If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a thumbs up or a star rating. And most of all, send us your comments. This podcast is issued under the Creative Commons license.